across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Where the windows are open, but only for another hour or two, because we're going to turn that song on its ear and say, baby, it's hot outside. The second hour of Up North News Radio for Tuesday, August 22nd, comes your way on National Tooth Fairy Day and World Plant Milk Day, or World Plant Fake Milk Day, depending on your point of view on that. Coming up this hour, we're about to visit with State Senator Kelderoys about two recent instances of Republicans getting attention for the wrong reasons. In one case, a Republican senator up north appears to be trying to sue a small news outlet out of business. And that same senator and two assembly colleagues are co-authors of a new bill that would gut work permits for 14 and 15-year-olds, making it harder to protect them from mistreatment and unsafe conditions. We're going to talk to a Wisconsin Farmers Union member who was recently at the White House to mark the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act. She will join our friend Hans Breitenmoser coming up at the bottom of the hour. We'll have the weatherology forecast from meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki coming up, and Chad Holmes from Bull Falls Radio in Wausau will join us to close out the show as well. Anytime along the way, if you've got questions, concerns, opinions, you can share with us at 844-967-2789. You can email us radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Don't forget the WI. Or you can comment on any of our live social media feeds where you can find the show as well. And to the show, we are proud and happy to welcome State Senator Kelderoys. Kelda, how are you?
I'm great. Happy to be back with you.
Yeah, so nice to have you here. We'll try to cover a lot of ground here. I've mentioned a couple topics, and of course, we have, you know, Governor Evers calling a special session, basically asking Republicans to try to address some of the things they didn't address in the state budget. You're a member of the Joint Finance Committee, so if time allows, we'll certainly ask about things that they're doing, including the layoffs, or furloughs rather, that were just announced at UW Parkside because of tight budgets and things like that. But where I really wanted to start was on one of your colleagues who wasn't a colleague when this all began, but we passed on the story a few days back, and we were rather, I guess surprised is the right way to put it, that the New York Times picked up on the story about how Corey Tomchek was reported in the Wausau Pilot and Review as using a homophobic slur in a public setting. Other people said, yes, he did. He says he didn't. He's suing the site, and it's running up such legal bills that its you know, existence is in jeopardy, even as he's since been elected to the Wisconsin State Senate. And I had said, you know, Kelda, in tossing this to you, that I think now that he's a state senator, he should show a bit more respect for a free press and not continue on this legal path. And I just wanted to get your input on this now colleague of yours and, you know, the significance of a state elected official suing a news outlet.
Yeah, I think it sets a terrible precedent. And unfortunately, too often we have seen many politicians, and especially Republican and conservative politicians, using the media as a punching bag. And I think it is very important, and it is fine to criticize the media and to push back on coverage that you feel is unfair or inaccurate. But the bottom line is that we cannot have a functioning democracy if we abuse the media in this way. And what Senator Tomchek is doing is abusing the legal process to try to silence his critics who are legitimately reporting. He is a public figure. And the fact that he doesn't like being exposed as an anti-gay bigot is understandable, but he doesn't get to use the legal system to try to silence legitimate reporting about it.
And let's be clear that he has said, he has confirmed using that particular slur or a variation of that slur in the past, that it's been a part of his vocabulary. So it's not, he's not even saying he never uses it. He just claims he didn't in a certain circumstance, even though, like I said, other people, you know, say that he did. The fact that this is now going to cost the Wausau Pilot and Review thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, it does have that chilling effect. And it just seems like it's an extension of what was then a sitting president of the United States referring to a free press as the enemy of the people, something that should have brought tremendous condemnation. And it used to in a simpler time and place.
I think that's right. For him to be attacking the press for reporting something, and using the legal system to essentially bury it in costs and fees so that it can't continue is a travesty. We have already seen massive consolidation in the media industry over my lifetime. And it has meant that we have far, far fewer journalists and reporters that are out there, especially covering local issues. So we really cannot afford to lose more local journalists and local media outlets. Unfortunately, these kind of tactics are all too effective when it comes to the financial realities of trying to run a small news organization in today's media climate and just the economics of news.
Senator Kelderoys is our guest. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to get an update on the weather forecast from weatherology meteorologist Jennifer Vucicki. A quick update on the Brewers who were off yesterday, and then more of our conversation with Senator Roys. And then coming up at the bottom of the hour, Hans Breitenmoser and a guest will talk about the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act and how it was marked at the White House. Wherever you're listening across the state of Wisconsin on this beautiful, soon-to-be hot Tuesday, when you're here, you're up north. We'll be right back. Marking the anniversary of the birth of John Lee Hooker, born this day in 1917, passed away in 2001. Temps around the state, you can, if you're watching our live video feed, you can see those right now. And you'll see that we're going to get into the 90s all across Wisconsin today. And again, it's going to be even warmer tomorrow. And so for all the details on that, we're going to get the weatherology forecast right now from meteorologist Michael Cairo, who joins us. Michael, good morning.
Good morning to you. And yes, the hottest day pretty much statewide, especially there for tomorrow. We do have an excessive heat warning that goes into effect on Wednesday, pretty much from about Stevens Point on the southward there for the day on Wednesday. But already for today, we do have that heat advisory that goes into effect for this afternoon, including Madison, an excessive heat warning across far western portions of the state by this afternoon. That's the best chance of seeing some mid-90s, especially areas like La Crosse up to near Black River Falls, as well as Eau Claire. I think closer to the 90-degree mark for Madison up to near Wisconsin Rapids, and then some mid-80s expected over towards the Fox River Valley region yet for today. So again, the hottest conditions for today, especially across the western two-thirds of the state. Pretty humid out there as well. Those dew point values climbing up well into the 60s. Could even see some 70-degree dew points across the far western portions of the state. So starting to feel more tropical out there as far as those humidity values as a warm frontal boundary works in from the west. And then for tonight, not much of a cool down and staying pretty muggy overnight. So not the best sleeping weather if you don't have AC for tonight. Those overnight lows only dropping back into the 70s. Again, looking very hot on Wednesday. Could even get into record territory, especially across the southern two-thirds of the state. I was looking at some of the records of Madison and Milwaukee tomorrow. The record high set back in 1947 of 98 degrees, and we're going to get pretty close as we are forecasting actual highs in the upper 90s, but could feel as hot as 110 degrees as far as the heat index values. That's why we do have that excessive heat warning there for Wednesday and into your Wednesday evening time frame. Still pretty hot by the time we get to Thursday, just a marginally less hot compared to Wednesday. Still managing highs in the lower 90s for La Crosse, down to near Richland Center, as well as Madison. Upper 80s, I think, for Wausau, as well as the Fox River Valley. And then a cold frontal boundary looks to work in from the northwest Thursday night, bringing a very slight chance for some hit-or-miss type showers and storms, but also some cooler conditions for Friday and especially into your weekend. We're back in the mid-80s across the southern half of the state on Friday, and then everyone getting back in on the 70s for highs by the time we get to Saturday. So some light at the end of the tunnel as far as some comfortable conditions for your weekend, but have to get through a couple of very hot and muggy days until then.
And I was going to say, in the meantime, this is advice that is almost cliche, but has to be said every time. Keep the pets watered and don't leave pets or kids in the car. It's going to be that serious. Michael, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Stay cool.
All right, will do. Thank you so much. Milwaukee Brewers were off yesterday getting set for a two-game series against the Minnesota Twins tonight and then again tomorrow afternoon at American Family Field. Senator Kelda Royz is back with us now. And before we wrap up our consideration of your state Senate colleague and his lawsuit against the Wausau Pilot and Review, again, it's worth noting that this is not something that continues to be shall we say, adjudicated, in that there's been no sign that there was, you know, actual malice involved, which is the kind of standard that it would take to successfully sue a news outlet for defamation. What I'm wondering, Kelda, is whether other Republican colleagues have spoken about this and might want to speak on behalf of a free press rather than trying to, you know, bully or sue one out of existence.
I would certainly hope so, but, you know, they haven't really been asked. You know, part of the problem with not having a robust free press and not having enough reporters in the Capitol is that we don't have enough, they don't have enough time to run down these stories and to go ask, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, what do you think about one of your members calling a 13-year-old boy an anti-gay slur, the F word, at a public meeting where he was speaking? You know, in and his mother heard it, and that's how this whole thing started. So let's not forget how this began. It's with his own bigotry. He admits he uses that word. And I love to see other Republicans being asked what they think of this behavior and do they think it's acceptable.
And it really does come back to that whole notion of civility. And again, he wasn't a state senator at the time. That's not an excuse. He should know better than to do, you know, that kind of name calling in a public forum. Any grown up should do that. All right. He happens to be as well co-author of a bill that we're just learning about here that would eliminate work permits for 14 and 15 year olds. Right now, under current law, 14 and 15 year olds are prohibited from working most jobs unless they have permission from a parent or guardian and they have verified their age with the State Department of Workforce Development. The department can revoke youth work permits at any time if it believes a child's safety is being threatened. And so if you don't have the permits, it gets more difficult to investigate violations because there are fewer records of where the kids are being employed. Senator Royz, I cannot imagine that a bill like this would actually pass. I can't imagine. I'm sorry. I can't imagine. I can't believe it has been proposed, that it's even been proposed.
It's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, Republicans don't seem interested in actually addressing the workforce challenges that we face. They defunded childcare, which is one of the most significant barriers to people getting back to work. We already have very high record labor force participation. Post-pandemic, we have low unemployment, but the people who want to be working and can't, it's often because they cannot find reliable or affordable childcare. Republicans have made that problem much worse. Their whole answer to the workforce shortage seems to be, let's deregulate child labor. Let's get those kids, you know, serving alcohol. Let's make sure that they can go to work without their parents signing off on it, you know, regardless of how bad their grades are or, you know, what the family needs. And it's disappointing to see, but I guess it's not surprising. I mean, this is a Republican Party that has waged a war on higher education. They did a functional budget cut to the technical colleges just because they wouldn't even give them an inflationary increase. They cut $32 million from the University of Wisconsin, and we're seeing layoffs around the state as a result of that. And all this is at a time when we have a $7 billion surplus and a workforce shortage. So it's very hard to take these efforts seriously as anything other than just their general antipathy to doing anything that might protect kids.
Yeah, and it should be noted that earlier this year, the U.S. Labor Department fined a Wisconsin-based meatpacking contractor, Packer Sanitation, more than $1 million for employing at least 100 children, some as young as 13, to clean dangerous equipment such as bone saws and skull splitters in meatpacking plants across the U.S. This is a time when we actually need more supervision of potential child labor. But instead, you've got State Representatives Clint Moses and Amy Binsfield and State Senator Corey Chomchek saying that youth work permits are, quote, needless administrative barriers that slow down the hiring process. Well, we already know what Corey Tomchek thinks of similar protections in the law for things like, you know, a free press. That'll highlight it when he says dumb things like this. So it's not the world's biggest surprise. But again, I just really am going to be curious to see how many Republicans sign on to this. And then if it's allowed to come up to a vote, how many people really want to go on record with this? I don't know which way leadership will go on this as far as saying, okay, you sponsored it, that's fine. Or saying, yeah, let's push this thing through and dare Governor Evers to veto it.
Keep in mind that this is the same party that wants to force 10, 12, 14-year-olds into giving birth, even if they've been sexually assaulted. And so this is not a party that we can rely on to have the best interests of children at the forefront of their policymaking.
No, they have not. And it's seen in other ways as well. For example, child care counts and the other matters that are going to be before the legislature in a potential special session, one that the governor has called. Again, maybe the 13th time is the charm, where Republicans will take some of these problems seriously rather than gavel in and gavel out. And again, even though we can all assume that's what they're going to do, I don't think that should stop anybody, yourself included, from making the case that they should take this seriously and do something, not just for the parents and for the childcare producer or childcare providers, but as we mentioned earlier, for the employers, for businesses of all sizes. I'm sure you hear about that throughout your district and as you travel with Joint Finance around the state.
I do. And in fact, that came through loud and clear. Of course, we heard heart-wrenching stories from parents who, you know, couldn't find affordable care and then were forced to drop out of the workforce. And then that harms that family's economic security forever. You know, if you're out of the workforce for a few years, it is very, very hard to get back in at the level that you were. But we also heard about the impact from employers. And I was surprised, even employers who came to testify about other things in the budget often would say, and by the way, we really need childcare. It's a huge problem for our employees. You know, there are even people who can afford it can often not find childcare, to say nothing of the people who, you know, struggle to afford basic childcare. This is a problem throughout our state, and it's been for many years.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that predates the pandemic, along with, you know, the other workforce challenges like the baby boomers retiring. Again, that was something we knew about before the pandemic. It's just that now that we're on the, you know, the other side of the worst of the pandemic, and you have a record budget surplus, you have all these opportunities to address these issues finally. And there were so many lost opportunities in this budget. And that includes coming back to something you said a minute ago, the what I call the symbolic cut to the UW system for having the audacity to embrace diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's led to decisions like UW Oshkosh for layoffs and furloughs. UW Parkside is going to do furloughs. It's rumored that UW Platteville might not be far behind. Again, as a member of the Joint Finance Committee, we didn't sit through the meetings. You had to. So when you were hearing the, you know, the dozen Republicans on that committee talking about the UW system and its budget, what is it that you were hearing from them that really signaled the disconnect between proper funding of our universities and the labor shortage?
You know, for mostly they just sat there silently. They did not explain their decisions. They did not defend their decision to slash millions from the University of Wisconsin system's budget at a time when we have a workforce shortage and a huge surplus. They took the votes to cut the university. And, you know, the fact that they're using this sort of window dressing excuse of diversity, equity, inclusion, I think when you look back at the last several decades and you see the grievous cuts that Republicans have gleefully inflicted on the University of Wisconsin and higher ed in general, here and around the country, it's clear that their goal is to defund public higher education, to make it less affordable and less accessible for all young people in the state. And, you know, it's not just this budget cycle, it's every, you know, budget cycle in the Walker era. and many before that. So this is a long-standing war on higher education that's being waged by Republican politicians.
State Senator Kelda Royce, a member of the Joint Finance Committee, always great to hear from you. Kelda, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
All right. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Hans Breitenmoser and Rachel Baressa, who was at the White House recently to mark the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act and the many benefits it's already brought to Wisconsin and many more yet to come. That's all just ahead here on Up North News Radio for this Tuesday. We'll be back. This is apropos of almost nothing other than that the Cadillac Motor Company was founded on this day in 1902. And when you go with Pink Cadillac, you could go with Bruce, you could go with the Pointer Sisters, or you could go with Natalie Cole. And that's where we're going today. Our friend Hans Breitenmoser joins us every other Tuesday from his dairy farm up near Merrill in Lincoln County. Often brings along a friend to tell us more about some issues across rural Wisconsin. And that includes today, Rachel Baressa, who is a board member for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Hans, how you doing?
I'm fine, Pat. How are you doing?
Very good. Very good. Thanks. Rachel, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure's all ours, especially as we learned more about you in the break in terms of everything that you do. And all I said, after she mentioned being an at-large director on the state board for Wisconsin Farmers Union, all she said was, you know, doing some rotational grazing of beef cows in Waupaca County, raising two small kids, working for a nonprofit that does grazing education, waitressing fish fries at a campground. So, I mean, you found time to talk to us, which sounds like a near miracle at this point, Rachel.
Yeah, I've already had a few things that I've gotten done today, and I've gotten a whole list after this. So.
Of course, you've got a list.
This is the fun part.
Yeah, well, good. Well, part of the fun part as well had to be this recent trip to the White House. How did that come about?
Yeah, I got a call last Wednesday afternoon, I guess it was, just saying that they're going to be doing this inflation reduction anniversary event at the White House. And if I was participating in the programs and if I was interested in going, and I said, well, that's a once in a lifetime opportunity and you make it happen. I always say you say yes and then figure it out. So Thursday morning when I was on my way down to a hearing in Madison, in a Zoom meeting and pumping gas, the White House called. And I didn't feel like I could tell him, I'll call him right back. So, but then it wasn't until Monday that I got the official invite. So then I flew out on Tuesday. There was a group of other farmers and I, and we got to meet at the White House at 12:30 and get brought through security and join the other group of participants, because the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, doesn't just address agriculture. There's other sectors that were impacted by it. So it was kind of a representative group of the different sectors. But the two other farmers I was with, one was a farmer rancher from Colorado, and then the other one was from New Hampshire. And then there was a dairy farmer from Pennsylvania as well. And we got along really great. And it was really, really cool to be there.
You know, the Inflation Reduction Act got its name in part because of the politics of the moment. You know, inflation was still high and the Biden administration wanted to show that, you know, it was taking it seriously and making certain investments that would help tame inflation and lower costs for Americans. But the name is a bit of a misnomer because it also does so much more in terms of making what I would say are some long overdue investments that are going to be good for jobs, but good for the environment, and especially good for rural America, including Wisconsin. So as a Wisconsin farmer representing, you know, that sector at the White House event, can you tell me a couple of things about, you know, what's in the Inflation Reduction Act that, in your view, are going to be especially good for the rural economy?
Well, there's a couple different components of it. There's the direct programs, which, you know, EQIP, CSP, and RCPP are the primary ones. And these are different programs that farmers can use to implement conservation practices on their farm. EQIP and CSP specifically. The RCPP program is a partnership program that has really, I feel like, kind of changed the dynamic with NRCS and getting these programs out to farmers in Wisconsin. A lot of that is partnerships with other organizations in the state to increase that staffing, increase that technical assistance. So it's a lot of it, you know, getting farmers into our, you know, local NRCS offices and having them sign up for these programs and getting this funding out is what I think is really important.
And the funding will do what? Is it about positions? Is it about helping farmers implement conservation practices? You know, you or Hans can tell us a bit more about where exactly the money goes.
The RCPP money goes to these different organizations that are, like I said, helping with technical assistance, helping write the plans to implement the practices. But then a lot of the practices are, you know, manage grazing, cover crops, you know, the different, there's a whole kind of suite of climate smart ag practices that are often utilized by more small, medium-sized farmers. So it's kind of leveraging those operations to make them, you know, compatible with also those ecosystem services enhancements too, which I think that, you know, that's a lot that we need to focus on too.
Here's the thing I like about conversations like this, and, you know, setting the acronyms aside and everything, and Hans, I'll throw this to you first, is I love any time that we can help people learn that any given job isn't nearly as simple as you might think. Here, I don't just open up a microphone and start yapping. There's a lot of preparation that goes into this. Mm-hmm. For farming, it's not, well, I go plant a few seeds, I milk a couple of cows, and it's done. Everything that Rachel just told us is about the intricacies of how you can, I'll use the word massage, how you massage the land and the way you utilize it in a way that can be either really bad for the environment or, you know, much more beneficial or do less harm. And it's kind of interesting to explain those subtleties of farming to others. At least I enjoy it. I don't know if you do, Hans. I think you actually do.
Well, I do. I do because I think that, you know, like Rachel and I, this is what we do for a living. And so for us, it's not terribly exotic, but knowing how few farmers are left, there are a lot of people who appreciate getting a little education. And most people are very surprised about how many moving parts there are, in all the things that we do. But it also illustrates, I think, how important, once again, public policy is, good public policy that addresses the ag sector in terms of, you know, best practices when it comes to environmental issues and all the things. Technology is moving very, very quickly in the ag sector, arguably faster than any other sector. And so public policy has to keep up with that. And knowing how much good we can do out on the land in terms of the environment, and also understanding the energy future in terms of renewable energy, a lot of that is coming from the rural areas. I think that, it's been real good that the IRA addressed that and understands that at the level that it does.
So, Rachel, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's good policy. It does a lot for throughout the area. And we've talked about some of the other green energy and manufacturing jobs aspects of it. But in terms of making farming, you know, more resilient and providing the assistance that you need, is that something that is just the... Is that just insight from a few, you know, progressive farmers who are out there? Or do you feel like a whole swath of farmers, ranchers, and producers will appreciate the changes that the Inflation Reduction Act is going to bring?
I mean, I guess I would like it so that, you know, these producers that are doing their practices, their farming that is kind of an environmentally sound benefit, are leveraged in the same way that someone that's growing corn and soy are. So there's a lot of different subsidies and insurance that, you know, makes it so that no matter what, those farmers can be profitable. So it's just nice that there's policy and practices or programs that, you know, kind of will buoy the small and medium-sized farmers in rough years. And to compensate, you know, for those, like I said, the ecosystem services, the benefits to our rural communities.
When you were doing this at the White House, and you talked about meeting a couple of farmers, but I mean, did you find yourself, you know, rubbing elbows with any other, you know, VIPs who were there? I mean, somebody from the level of Hans, you know, on upwards, you know, in terms of, you know,
I'm not getting any invites to the White House.
Excuse me, Hans, I'm looking right here at a website called Barn Raising Media, and they just did a very glowing profile of you. So, you know, you're a celebrity in my book. Don't sell yourself short over there. But Rachel, what other impressions did you take away from the White House trip?
It was definitely kind of a, you know, party atmosphere that there was this reception. You know, I went with kind of more talking points prepared, which of course I don't have in front of me right now, and kind of was hoping to be able to speak to the impacts, you know, at the higher level. But it was more meet and greet, which is fine because we've got our Wisconsin Farmers Union fly-in where Farmers Union members can go out to DC and actually have organized meetings with our representatives coming up next month. So that's, you know, when I think one of the prep questions was what brought me into Farmers Union. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of that discussion of policy and realizing that impact of policy on, you know, our landscape and in our communities, and then being able to kind of access our representatives through Farmers Union. And I still would say that that's kind of my favorite part. Well, one of my favorite parts of being a member in the organization.
It really gets to the heart of what we did in starting Up North News. And we've heard this from the Motherhood for Good people as well. And I think the same thing applies to Farmers Union. Don't say you don't do politics, because if you say that, you're going to find out that politics will do you. So you may as well be involved and have a voice in this. If I can turn to the energy efficiency aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act, because, again, farm families are like any other families. They've got to have a home. Sometimes that home is, you know, long overdue for remodeling and things like that. And so the energy efficiency improvements that can be made, whether it's appliances or remodeling or adding a solar or wind component or anything like that, I mean, that's as beneficial to a farm homeowner as it is anybody in the suburbs, right?
Well, I sure think so. I mean, you know, we know a lot of pretty old farmhouses out in the country that would do well to have new windows or updated heating systems and so forth. So I think, yeah, that impacts rural America as much as it does urban America. And as I said before, I think a lot of, you know, there is so much potential out in the countryside to be producing green energy. We've got solar panels on two of our barns and quite proud of that. You know, they work very well. So to anything to encourage that is good for the environment, but it also brings money to rural communities. And that's not a small thing in my view.
No, not at all. Rachel, I got time for one more thing. You mentioned the rotational grazing that you do. And I thought I might just ask about that really quick in that what led you into that? We're getting so used to hearing about, you know, mega farms where thousands of cows, you know, never set foot in a pasture or something like that. And you're doing quite the opposite. So it sounds to me like there's still plenty of market share out there for what you're doing in terms of, you know, the output for the consumer.
Yeah, I guess I got into managed grazing early. My parents were some of the first to transition to managed grazing in the late 90s. So I was a middle schooler echoing the mantra of why plant crops, bring crops to the animals, then have to, you know, get rid of the waste when it's better for the land, better for the farmer, better for the animals to let the animals do the work. So with managed grazing, you know, I move my animals each day to fresh grass, and then they're kind of completing that cycle. There's a lot of diversity in the pasture. It's more kind of a mimicking natural ecosystems, and it requires less inputs, less fertilizer, less diesel used. I use my four-wheeler most days. So yeah, and then as far as, you know, I do direct marketing and invite a lot of customers out to my farm. My line is always, there's, you know, agriculture comprises 40% of agriculture, and it can't all be CAFOs and corn.
No, ma'am. No, it can't. And I have to say, I'm really glad I had time to ask you about that, because some days when I get down about the corporatization and industrialization of farming, I get to think about people like you doing what you do. And thank you so much for it and for representing us in that recent event out at the White House as well. Rachel Baressa, thank you so much. Hans Breitenmoser, good to talk to you as well.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Brad.
All right. You guys have a wonderful day. And when we come back, Chad Holmes from Bull Falls Radio will tell us about his show coming up minutes away here on Bull Falls Radio on the Central Media Civic Media Radio Network. Easy for me to say. We'll be right back.
I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man.
Yeah, it's back. Because Chad Holmes is back on the bus, traveling here, there, everywhere. All the way in Superior last, it was Superior last Friday night, right?
It was Superior last Friday into early Saturday morning.
I saw your social media updates about traveling up there to cover Wausau West football, and then later on I used the Civic Media app to listen in to the game for a bit, and it was just nice to hear what a pro sounds like calling a high school football game.
I appreciate that. It was nice to remember how to do it. It's been a while since I've done football, and it's a short season for the high schools, and it was great to be back doing some high school sports after a few months.
Oh, no, I thought it was great. And again, all of the communities that Civic Media serves that are doing high school sports like this is just a tremendous public service and deserves to be supported whenever possible. So, Chad, we were talking earlier, not just today, but a couple of days back, about the New York Times story about Corey Tomchek and, you know, bringing suit against the Wausau Pilot and Review, and I mean pushing it to the point where it you know, conceivably could go out of business because of all the legal bills. You're going to be talking to one of the people at the center of all this tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow morning, scheduled to have at 9:15, Shireen Seewert, who is the founder and we call it the publisher of the Wausau Pilot and Review. And as you said, State Senator Corey Tomchek continues to fight it. And this suit was already dismissed in circuit court, but he's continuing to push it. And obviously, if you continue to push it, appeal it, and try to keep it in the system, the costs continue to rise. And the Wausau Pilot and Review is not one of these major publications backed by a conglomerate such as Gannett or something like that, and the legal bills continue to rise, and it puts the entire future of a very important source of local news in this community in danger. So we'll talk about the issues involved in it, obviously, that ultimately led to Tomchek trying to go to court on this, and also what it means as this continues in the courts. And real quickly, Pat, you've heard it over the years. How many times have we heard over the years from those on the right about frivolous lawsuits, about how they were going to go into and make laws that we don't have to worry about frivolous lawsuits? And normally their definition of frivolous lawsuits involved lawsuits that people actually have bodily harm. Well, we can't have, these large judgments that put everybody out of business. Well, in a case like this, this is the example, the textbook example of a frivolous lawsuit. And it ultimately is. And I think we've been hearing about, in the discussions about how this is basically a person using their wealth to try and put what they would consider an opponent out of business.
It is. But again, it's a case of, the one set of rules for, the people you like and another for those that you don't. And it isn't just about frivolous lawsuits, but it's also about books. And we'll get into that in a second. It's also about flags, the flag you like versus the flag you don't. And to that end, Kristen Lyerly sent me a note about how there was going to be a meeting at DePere High School yesterday about a flag policy that would have restricted flags only to the U.S. flag, the state flag, the school flag, and the POW MIA flag. In other words, a way to say, well, you can't fly you know, say an LGBTQ flag because, let me see the note here from the Brown County Republican Party. Oh, the time to stand up against the liberal propaganda machine is now. Because I guess tolerance for a flag is now liberal propaganda. But, you know, it's flags, and you mentioned books as well. And not just outright book bans, but backdoor ways to go about book bans. What kind of things are you talking about there?
Yeah, last week there was an ad put in our local weekly paper, the City Pages, talking about being at a library board meeting. It's one of those board meetings that occurred yesterday at 12 noon. Yeah, sometimes I think people, you know, obviously are working and may just, you know, let it slip by. And it's a group that in the ad, it did not have who it was paid for. And then the newspaper came out and said, "Oh, that was a mistake in how it was printed out." And we still don't know a lot about this organization, but yesterday was the meeting, and it's again trying to push some sort of library rating system because people in this group claim there are pornographic materials in the library. And again, they use the, you know, the most, it's like yelling fire in a theater. They're trying to really get people going. And but again, it's all about, instead of worrying about you and your family and the kind of books that you and your family want to read, they want to tell everybody else what they want to read. Say again, you can talk about, you know, if you're against the LGBTQ community, well, that book obviously is pornographic. I mean, this is really upsetting to me, and I'm going to continue to talk about that today, that this group, and we don't know where the funding's coming from. So many of these groups have this funding that we don't know where it's coming from. Is this truly a grassroots community within our community, or is this another national organization putting money all over the place to try to get their agenda passed in community after community? So again, yesterday we had this meeting. There was no decision made on any changes at the Marathon County Public Library. But again, this is continuous. And, you know, we have to keep watching this over and over and over again. And the idea of freedom is something I'm going to talk about a little bit today. As I'm going to go outside the bubble with our good friend Oliver Burrows today, and I'm going to discuss the issue of freedom with him as a conservative. Because how many times do we hear conservatives talk about freedom? And yet, right now in this country, you can go healthcare, you can talk about books, and you can talk about many other issues where they are actually taking freedoms away from us to make our own decisions. And how can they have possession of the term freedom every election, and yet their actions seem to be the opposite of it? And again, it's just things that are on my mind that I'm going to take the opportunity with a microphone in front of my face in the next 2 hours to discuss.
I think you should, because look, the vigilance has to be eternal, especially in an era where what appears to be grassroots is actually AstroTurf. Exactly. And the most recent example would be Moms for Liberty. But prior to that, it would have been things like the Tea Party, where, again, they try to make it sound like just a few Americans are mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. And then you come to find out that they're actually very well funded by, you know, huge right wing endowments and funds and things like that. And, you know, in the case of Moms for Liberty, you've now got a group that is essentially on record as being, if not a hate group, then something awfully close to it for the way that it wants to ban books and things like that. So the only way that we stay on top of these things is, you know, people like you putting a microphone in front of your mouth for, you know, a couple of hours every day. And you can catch Chad doing that on Bull Falls Radio in just a matter of minutes. Chad, thanks so much. Appreciate it always. Talk to you again soon.
You bet. Thank you, Pat.
All right. Tomorrow we'll have our weekly climate check with Melissa Baldoff. And you can also be in touch with us anytime by sending an email, radio@upnorthnewswi.com. You can stay up to date on our newsletter by signing up at upnorthnewswi.com. Click newsletter in the top banner or click store, and you can get some of that new merchandise that we got, the T-shirts and such, tote bags and more. Plenty of show options coming up next across the Civic Media Radio Network. Have a wonderful Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow.